Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. This weekend, President Trump is scheduled to hold his first major campaign rally since the COVID-19 pandemic began. It will be held in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the city where 99 years ago this spring, a white mob incinerated a prosperous African-American enclave known as Black Wall Street. The city's Greenwood section was burned to the ground. As many as 300 people died, thousands were left homeless, and no arrests were ever made. For Tulsa's Black community, the pain has never gone away, which is one reason that the president's decision to hold a rally there generated major backlash. The other reason is that it was to be held on June 19th, or Juneteenth, the anniversary of the day in 1865 that the last enslaved African Americans learned that they had been set free. The president has since pushed the rally back by a day. We'll hear about how Tulsa is commemorating the 1921 race massacre in just a bit, but we begin with Juneteenth, the history, the efforts to make it a federal holiday, and why this year it carries even greater significance. For that, we are joined by Ronald Brown, founder and CEO of the Pennsylvania Juneteenth Commission. Ron, welcome to Radio Times.
I thank you so much. This is a blessing just to be here on this station.
Well,
which I have a lot of admiration for.
Well, thank you so much. We're so glad you could join us. And why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about Juneteenth? What is it exactly?
See, it's interesting you say that. Juneteenth is actually a part of American history. And even though D-Day was June 19th, 1865. There was a history that existed prior to that, a freedom march prior to that, that migrated to that particular day. And actually, it actually goes back to Philadelphia. It's so interesting. Here, you had the Quakers. The Quakers was abused and they had to experience a very similar stuff that the Africans actually were experiencing there in York because of their approach to the religion. They was in the community, in the streets, talking about the religion to the Protestants that was there. And as a result of that, they was imprisoned and they was hands cut off, murdered. It's a lot of stuff that happened to them. But they was fortunate in that William Penn, His father happened to capture Jamaica, and as a result of him capturing Jamaica, the King Charles owed him a debt, and so when he passed, William Penn inherited his father's debt, which is the slaves, and so one of the things he asked for from Charles, he asked for the site of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Chester, Delaware, right in that area. He asked for that area, and the king granted. And so he said, you're taking those people too? And he said, yes, that was the purpose. And so they migrated from that point all the way to the area of Delaware, and then further down. And so that there, fortunately for the African-Americans, because of the experience that the Quakers had, they were very sympathetic towards those African-Americans. And one is also saying, because of what they did, the experience, they decided to, those slaves, which they chose, were slaves that, they was built, they had, they was chosen to, especially the male, to do the chores, but as well as protect them from anybody that would do harm to them. Mm-hmm. And so that was very, and so here you have Philadelphia. So when you talk about the White House, the first White House, you talk about Philadelphia. When you talk about the first legislation, the first Supreme Court, the first Congress, the first bank, the second bank, the third bank, you're talking about Philadelphia. All the foundations started here.
I had no idea, Ron, about the Philadelphia connection to all this.
Really interesting.
And tell us a little bit about what actually happened in Galveston, because I think when people think about Juneteenth, they think Texas. What played out in Galveston?
So, So see, that's what I say. You have to go just a little bit before, and I'm going to go you right to Galveston because you'll be able to understand the Philadelphia connection. Now, when the Civil War, after going through all this, you know, as I mentioned, the redlining and racism started. Northern racism started in Philadelphia through Nicholas Biddle, and so here you had the serious racism that's going on between the Irish attacking the blacks because they wanted to be jobs from the 1830s up to the 1850s. So when the 1860s came, you know, that's when the Civil War broke out. And so what they did, they enlisted Africans from the 7th Ward in Philadelphia. So you're talking from 6th Street all the way to like 26th Street, from Bainbridge all the way to Locust, right into that area with an African-American community. So Octavius Cato recruited Frederick Douglass, Jacob White. They recruited these Africans from there. And it was those Africans that enrolled to a place called Camp William Penn, where in Cheltenham Township, McLean County. Or if you know where the Cheltenham Mall is, right there. And so it was those Africans from that camp that trained at that camp. They was trained as specialists. And so they was the one that marched, went all the way to Virginia and battled against the Confederacy, which was the capital. Virginia was the capital of these, it was the Confederate capital. So they battled against the Confederates in Petersburg. They beat them there. They defeated them there in New Market Heights, you know. And then when the Confederates abandoned their capital, Richmond, they went to Appomattox, Virginia. And so where General Robert E. Lee was at. And so those Africans battled against Robert E. Lee. And because of that battle, they was able to defeat General Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy. And then from there, after they defeat them, and they changed them to a special force, just before they went to battle Robert, they became the 25th Corps. And just before they went to battle them, that's when they went in as the 25th Corps. There were six of those infantry from Camp William Penn that turned into the 25th Corps. And then after they defeated them, they was mustered to Texas. And so they went from, when they went to, got to Texas, they went from plantation to plantation, freeing the Africans, because that was the last state that needed to be, out of the Africans that needed to be free. And so they went from plantation to plantation until they came upon the last of the Africans that was enslaved, you know, in America, was some of the last of the Africans that was enslaved in Texas. And as they came upon General Granger, we had General Order Number 3. This was on June 19, 1865. So when they first came into Texas, it was on June 13th. And so now they're on June 19, 1865. And General Gordon Granger is reading to the last of the slave Africans General Order Number 3. General Order Number 3 basically was the enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation. So we're talking about 2 years, 5 months, and 18 days after that proclamation was issued. Here you have this Granger reading this General Order Number 3 to these last of the Africans, and it basically, you know, saying that, you know, that they had to now go and work for wages, and you know, yeah. but it says now you're forever more free. So when they said you are forever more free, it led into a spontaneous celebration in the streets of Galveston, Texas. You know, and they said, what do we call this? What do we call this? They said, well, because you know, this is in June, right? And it came, after it came, and the soldiers, USTs came in on the 13th. And so the T's, Juneteenth, and then here we are on the 19th, June 19th. They said, yeah, we'll call this Juneteenth.
So that's how the name came about. Why do you think, Ron, that this event has been kind of under the radar for so long? It seems like in recent years we're hearing more about it, but it was under the radar for a long time. Why do you think that is?
I tell you, it's so interesting you say that, because I started Juneteenth in Pennsylvania. I am the founder of Juneteenth. When I started, 99.9% of people in Pennsylvania did not know what that was. I didn't know. And so one of the things that, you know, people don't have information, you know, the key thing, a part of slavery is when you don't have information. And so that was one of the purpose of the slave master, to make sure that the African didn't have information. Because if he doesn't have information, the person has information, then you can enslave them with the information that you give them. And so the information that they gave them was July 4th, you know. And it's interesting, on July 4th, in the beginning, 1776, even in 1783, the Africans was enslaved on the plantations in the South. And those who was in Philadelphia was being murdered, being abused by, you know, attacked, especially here in Philadelphia, for trying to go to July 4th celebrations. And so, you know, but they had it because they, you know, that's the information they had. And yeah. So people were ignorant of that. But because they was ignorant of it, you know, when you see, people have to understand the degrees of slavery in which people are. So when you give people information and they said, oh, what's this new thing? You know, what is that? You know, and so one of the things I started in Germantown. And then I didn't know what it was. Fortunately, that my fiancé, no one in Philadelphia I knew. The libraries didn't have it. And then, but my then fiancé at the time, and she later died about a couple months after she gave me information, she told me that there was a day, and it was called Juneteenth. And so once I got that, I went down to the one library I didn't go to, was the main library, and they had one book. But Ron, I'm going to stop you right there
because I want to make sure that we can get as much information in as possible for time's sake before we have to say goodbye to you.
Yes.
We did hear today that Mayor Kenney has announced that Juneteenth is now going to be an official holiday for the city of Philadelphia. That had to be good news.
Well, one of the things that it was good news, and you know, Governor Cuomo declared the state of New York it's going to be next year. It's going to be a state holiday. Portland declared it. Over 100, and as of now, I count 150 corporations has declared that the CEO had said that that's going to be their holiday, paid holiday, for his paid holiday off. So it's actually the movement, and it's the time, you know, that's actually taking place. So it was good news. But I tell you, today is going to be great news for people. Today, people are going to be very surprised what happened today and tomorrow. You know, something very interesting is going to happen.
What do you mean?
The nation is going to get some great news. Great news.
And what
today.
What do you mean exactly?
You know, in reference to Juneteenth.
Okay. Ron, and I have to take a break in just a minute, but can you tell me very quickly, 60 seconds or less, typically, how is Juneteenth celebrated? What do people do to mark the occasion?
Well, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we have over 68 different organizations throughout the state of Pennsylvania that celebrate it in different ways. So, you know, so some might do it with a parade. It's got five organizations that does it in the state of Pennsylvania with parades, and they do it with a festival. You know, they have pageants, they have educational forums, they have plays, they have, you know, they celebrated all, everybody with their vision, they celebrated in all different type of ways, you know.
And of course, this year with the pandemic, that will change things a little bit.
Yes, I had to change it to, here in the state of Pennsylvania, virtual. So I had all the organizations do virtual programming. There will be probably about four, five, we're going to be doing public. And that was just recently, they made that decision to do that, you know. And so, yes, most of them are going to be doing virtual. You know, people are going to be able to, in their house, in their home, and it's going to be raining this week, be able to watch it on their computers and on our websites. And, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Ron Brown, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on Radio Times and helping us understand a little bit more about Juneteenth. Ron is the founder and CEO of the Pennsylvania Juneteenth Coalition. Stick around. Radio Times will be back with much more right after this.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about a couple of anniversaries. We've been talking about Juneteenth, which is observed June 19th. It commemorates the day in 1865 when the very last of the enslaved African Americans in Galveston, Texas, were given the news that they were free. We are also talking about the fact that President Trump decided that he would hold his first major campaign rally since the pandemic began in Tulsa on Juneteenth, June 19th. Well, while Juneteenth will no longer be the date for that rally, the president has not changed his mind about the location. It will be in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where 99 years ago, a white mob burned down the neighborhood known as Black Wall Street. The Greenwood section of Tulsa was a prosperous African-American enclave full of thriving businesses and wealthy entrepreneurs. The Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 is getting more attention in light of the rally, the opening scenes of Watchmen on HBO, and crucially, the racial reckoning underway across America. As the 100-year anniversary approaches, the Tulsa Race Massacre is also the focus of a major effort to educate the nation and the world about a critical and long underrecognized event in American history. Phil Armstrong is the project manager of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission, and he joins us now with more on what happened in his city, the renewed attention, and the community's hopes for the next 100 years. Phil Armstrong, welcome to Radio Times.
It's great to be here with you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Take us back to 1921 and tell us what happened in the Greenwood section.
Well, the one thing that I like to put in context is that as we teach this information and teach this history and actually train other teachers who get certified to teach this information, because it was neglected in Oklahoma public school history teaching for the last 30 to 40 years, is to give it some context and shape this. Oklahoma was no different than many prospering black communities due to Jim Crow laws of the South. It required, because of that, because legally or black citizens could not conduct, you know, commerce wherever they would want to go, regardless of how much money they had, it required them to be self-reliant, self-sufficient communities. And that's what caused them to be really successful, because they supported 100% each other. So there were several communities around the United States that could have been considered, quote unquote, a Black Wall Street. It's just that here in Tulsa, because of land ownership and because of the oil and gas boom that African Americans also participated in, that there was no other place in the United States that concentrated this much black wealth in one geographic area as Tulsa. Greenwood was about, in its peak, about 10 to 12,000 black citizens occupied this area of Greenwood, all black-owned homes, black-owned businesses, and it was a thriving African-American enclave. Booker T. Washington was the first to name this area Negro Wall Street. And, of course, in the 60s and 70s, that name and that moniker changed to Black Wall Street. Yeah. But from the 1907, when Oklahoma became a state, and 1907 all the way up to the early 1920s, this area just boomed with economic activity, specifically with African Americans. They drove wonderful cars. They dressed well. They lived in homes that actually surpassed many of their white counterparts. And that's really what caused the animosity, is that this side of town, if you were a white person in that time period, and you had this mindset of inferiority, and to note, the Ku Klux Klan grew and had its most significant growth in terms of membership in Oklahoma from 1919 to 1929. So this animosity of this community of people that you may see as inferior are prospering and doing so much better. So not only was there just racial hatred, there was racial animosity and jealousy. Mm-hmm. And so in 1921, you know, this thriving group in this thriving area, literally we refer to it as just a tinderbox ready for the striking of a match.
So what was the match, Phil, that, yeah, what was the match that set all of this off?
So the striking of the match was what's referred to as the elevator incident that took place May 30th, 1921, and a 19-year-old young black teenage boy named Dick Rowland. He'd actually dropped out of high school and was a shoeshine boy in downtown Tulsa. and a 17-year-old white girl by the name of Sarah Page. Sarah Page was an elevator operator in the Drexler Building. The Drexler Building is still there in Tulsa today, here in Tulsa today. And the Drexler Building on the third floor was the only building downtown Tulsa that had what were referred to as colored restrooms, the only place where blacks could use a restroom. And so he went to the Drexler Building to use the restroom, and there was a shifting of the elevator. It's been described as maybe the elevator shifted or did not rest correctly on the floor. But when he stepped on the elevator, he tripped. To steady himself, to keep from falling down, he grabbed the arm of Sarah Page to hold himself. And when he did that, it startled her. She screamed. When she screamed, the door opened up and he ran away. The white merchant across the street came over, heard the scream, tried to find out what happened. By that afternoon, the Tulsa Tribune, they're no longer in business now, but the Tulsa Tribune, really historians credit them for inciting or getting this massacre and the tension started by printing in their front page paper, "Nab Negro for attacking white girl on elevator."
And so that was sort of an invitation, if you will, Phil, right, to come after not only this individual, but this community.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're a white citizen, you see that in the paper, it was one of those moments that you can imagine the animosity in reading that. I mean, basically the paper described and was false accusations that he tore her clothes, that he scratched her, that he literally basically tried to rape a white girl in the broad daylight. And white citizens gathered, then they arrested Dick Rowland. May 31st, he's in the courthouse, and then a white mob of about 1,000 white citizens gather around the courthouse with the intentions to try to bring him out and lynch him. About 36 black citizens from Greenwood who served in the war, who were disciplined, were not afraid, grabbed their ammunition, grabbed their weapons, and they went downtown to defend him. Their whole sole intent was to make sure he was going to get his fair due process and just defend him to keep them from lynching this young man. Around between 10 and 10:30 that night, May 31st, one of the white citizens walked up to one of the black soldiers to disarm him. As they wrestle over the gun discharges, and what was printed in the paper at that moment, quote, unquote, all hell broke loose. And that was the first shots fired that started the massacre. The black citizens retreated to Greenwood. The mob increased from about 1,000 to 1,500. The Tulsa Police Department deputized many of them. They got guns. They got ammunition. And they began around 11:15 marching into Greenwood and began to loot, destroy, kill, and maim. And this went on for about 18 hours straight before martial law was declared.
You are listening to WHYY-FM. This is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak filling in for Marty Moscowane. Let me take a moment and invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. We are talking about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, partly in the context of President Trump's proposed rally there this weekend, but also just talking about the history as we approach the 100th anniversary next year. Feel free to give us a call at 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. We are talking with Phil Armstrong. He's the project director or project manager for the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. And Phil, so you were describing for us what led up to these events in the spring of 1921. And from my understanding, it's still not clear how many people died by the time it was all over. But they're saying perhaps several hundred.
Yes. So there were no records kept in the immediate aftermath. There are from the Oklahoma Historical Society, Tulsa Historical Society, we have newspaper articles and pictures and records and show where black bodies were actually loaded on wagons, on trucks, and they were taken to different various places in the city and mass graves, and they were buried there. And so, you know, when people look back and try to determine how many, the estimates are at least 300, but some would guess between 300 and 1,000. Again, there were about 10 to 12,000 African Americans who were living in Greenwood at that time. And after the massacre, many of the reports are based on those who no longer could find or see or heard from their loved one. And those numbers, again, around 300. But, you know, so that is one of the main things that the city of Tulsa is still grappling with, is the fact that, you know, these people were not you didn't have a mortician come down and claim bodies. You didn't have the city come in. Bodies were just collected and they were buried. And so just how barbaristic, if you will, that was, and how many people still don't have closure, especially if you have a direct relative that experienced that. But the community, as we and the commission in our work, one of the things that they really expressed to us is that, you know, don't just focus on the massacre. Yes, this massacre is what brings people here. It's what drives people to want to know more. But tell people about Greenwood, how Black people came to Oklahoma, how prosperous this place was, how unique and special it was. And then tell people that time did not just stop at 1921. These citizens who remained put their funds and their entrepreneurial mindset together, and they rebuilt Greenwood. Within 5 years after the massacre, 80 to 90% of Greenwood was rebuilt. And by the fifth year after the massacre, the National Negro Chamber of Commerce had their national meeting right here in Greenwood. And when I go to schools and I teach this information, I tell people you can't host a national conference unless you have hotels and restaurants and activities and places for people to go. So the true spirit of resilience and this entrepreneurial mindset is remarkable. Mm-hmm. That they did this, and keep in mind that they were not able to file any insurance claims. Because this was labeled a riot, none of their insurance policies, business or home or residential, would pay out. So they did all of this without aid from the city, without aid from insurance, which speaks to the amount of wealth and the drive of entrepreneurialism that was in this community. They could rebuild it. And in fact, it reached its peak. It was almost twice the size and saw its biggest peak in its wealth and activity in the mid-1940s.
And Phil, I absolutely do want to talk a little bit more about, you know, the resilience, about the wealth that was there. I don't want to gloss over some of the damage that was done. And I did want to clarify with you, and some of our listeners are asking about this as well. Going back to the events of those couple of days, my understanding was that something like 10,000 people were left homeless, that around 6,000 were placed in internment camps, that turpentine balls were dropped from planes. And again, I understand your point. I don't want to linger on all the bad stuff, but I also don't want to gloss over what was done there. Can you clarify that for us? Is that accurate?
Yes. You referenced in before I came on, referencing the first 3 minutes and 39 seconds of HBO's Watchmen. And we have been in constant contact and established a strong relationship with them, with the commission. In fact, Damon Lindelof, the executive producer and creator of Watchmen, has become a friend of the commission, has actually donated to the work of the commission and what we're doing here with building our museum. But that video Hollywood presentation of that first season one, episode one, was the first time that the world was able to kind of experience what it must have been like if you were standing in the midst of a riot back in 1921. And many reports and many reporters would call the first couple of weeks after that episode. Two questions would always come up. Did that really happen? Were there really planes dropping bombs? Or how much of that was Hollywood dramatization? And then when we would verify that, number two, the second question would be, how come nobody knows about this? And
right.
That's the point. And yes, so there were, so the Oklahoma Historical Society, we have the newspaper articles, we have the eyewitness accounts. because many of the African Americans fought back. That's why the damage and destruction went so long, because there was a struggle, there was a fight. And so by the early morning hours, those white citizens who owned planes actually lent their planes out. There was collaboration with some Tulsa Police Department members at that time, and verification accounts of that, and with the local guard armory, and they flew over. That's what caused really the severe damage. They were flying over Greenwood and dropping incendiary devices, kerosene bombs, and just dropping them on homes, on the businesses. And so these fires were starting at the rooftop of these businesses and homes and burning them straight to the ground. And when you look at the pictures and the devastation, it looks like an atomic bomb just leveled this area of the city, and that was the damage from the airplanes flying over. And yes, there were about 10,000 people homeless and displaced. Many, about 4,000, left the city, never to return again. But those that remained, as I mentioned before, decided to stay and decided to fight back and rebuild their homes, rebuild their businesses. But yes, many of those accounts that seem so shocking that you just mentioned are true accounts of what happened.
And you said yourself, Phil, that this has not been a well-known story. I saw a recent 60 Minutes piece about this where people from Tulsa were gathered, and many of them said that they were not even taught about this in school. Why is that?
So there's two narratives that I kind of bring out, and you had from the white perspective that and I tell this to many students in many schools and stuff that I talk about this. Listen, there are about 25,000-30,000 white citizens in Tulsa at this time. Not every white person was out to kill black people. The mob was about at its height, at its peak, was about 1,500 that went in and did this destruction, but a vast portion of the whites at that time, especially those who had domestic workers in their homes, they went to find their workers, their families. They brought them to their homes to protect them. Many of the churches, we have record of, I know, three prominent churches that are still in existence today that show in their minutes where they actually went out to find refugees, find those who had been victims, brought them to their churches, brought them and protected them, fed them, clothed them in their basement. So there was a huge humanitarian effort. But Tulsa was described at this time, because of the oil boom, as quote unquote the magic city. Mm-hmm. And those who that were in control and those citizens and the mayor and the Chamber of Commerce at that time, they did not want this black mark on the city to ruin that reputation. So there was a concerted effort to not talk about it, to teach it, to try to erase this from it. In fact, the Tulsa Tribune, in weeks and months afterwards, they actually destroyed many of their papers and many of their items. Thankfully,
Phil, I'm going to stop you right there. I got to take a quick break. Hold on to that thought. We'll talk more about the Tulsa Race Massacre when Radio Times comes right back. Welcome.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921. The centennial is coming up next year, and preparations are underway in Tulsa to memorialize that. The story has gained headlines recently because of President Trump's planned rally in Tulsa this weekend and how that has struck a chord with many people and resulted in some backlash as well. We have been talking with Phil Armstrong. He is the project manager of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. We've been talking about what exactly happened in the Greenwood section of Tulsa back in 1921, a very prosperous black community there that was burned to the ground by a white mob. But we are also wanting to talk about what does that mean in light of current events, and what is the future for Greenwood? What is the vision for the next 100 years for that community? So we invite you to give us a call at 888-477-9499 with your comments and questions for our guests. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Phil Armstrong, when we left off, we were talking about the fact that this has not been a well-known story, that in fact it sort of disappeared off the radar screen for a while and was not taught in schools. I want to fast forward a little bit to today. I mentioned that there was a 60 Minutes piece that aired recently that made the point that race relations in Tulsa are strained to this day, that the fallout from the events of 1921 are being felt even now. How is that playing out in Tulsa?
So Tulsa today, are we a better city in our race relations compared to 1921? Yes, that's a resounding yes. I mean, from levels of government to black and brown representation in our city council, in our state level. In fact, the founder and chair of our commission is African-American State Senator Kevin Matthews. So race relations have seen significant progress in this city as well as in this country. What keeps us in this state of constant battle or constant struggle in some pockets and some areas are situations like George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery that reminds this nation, reminds us that don't rest upon what you see. And you've probably heard this reference before. Just because we had a black president doesn't mean everything's okay, and now we can sing kumbaya. There are still elements of systemic racism that are in different pockets. And even in this city, there are still those. When this commission was first started, there was pushback. When the Tulsa Mass Graves investigation was relaunched and put out, there was a lot of pushback. Why are you doing this? Why are you getting people angry again? How are we supposed to get past this if you just keep bringing it back up? And so we use, or I've used, with the commission, inspiration from a quote from James Baldwin, African-American poet, when he said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And so the commission, you know, our efforts have been to educate, have been to unite over this. It is a tragedy, but we must face it. It happened. It's something that happened in our city. And we learn what caused it, what happened. We can make sure that we don't repeat some of those mistakes and actually become a point of healing and reconciliation right here in the city of Tulsa. We work with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation that's right here in Tulsa, and they have an annual symposium to talk about race, to talk about divisions in our country, in our nation. And so even though we have these moments where things seem to be not moving forward and we seem to be going back, the evidence that we are much better than we were is to see the amount of white citizens that are standing strong and standing with black and brown communities to say Black Lives Matter. You wouldn't have seen this in the 60s. Of course, you wouldn't have seen it in the 20s. But the overwhelming support of white citizens that are coming and standing in the community and saying, yes, white people talking to other white people, this has got to stop. And so those are things that are giving us hope, that are giving us the vision that, hey, our future is going to be much brighter than where we are now.
Phil, what did you make of President Trump's decision to hold his first major campaign rally since the coronavirus started in Tulsa this weekend?
So whether it's the president or whether it's any organization, the sacredness of this week, as you've been talking about, Juneteenth holds not just for black citizens, but for the nation. But black citizens and black communities, of course, understand the significance of what 1865 and how we celebrate and how we come together to celebrate each other, our culture, our heritage, and 1865. And so any message, any person, any voice that would detract from that is seen as a disrespect. So it's not political because we're a bipartisan commission. We have Republicans and Democrats on our commission. And we actually had Republicans and Democrats unite to contact the White House and say, don't do this on this day. This is just no matter how you spin this and no matter what you say, this is going to be a disrespect. It's going to be a distraction. It's going to disrupt the programming that was set aside for Juneteenth. And so, you know, we're thankful that they changed their mind and it's still going to be here the next day. And they have that right to do that. But our focus is to be pro-Greenwood, that we are here. We're in this historic area. We're on sacred ground. And we just don't want anything to distract from what this means to citizens of Greenwood and black citizens around this country.
I was watching the news last night, and I saw that people are already lining up for the rally outside the Box Center. And yet, Phil, Oklahoma is seeing a surge in coronavirus cases. What are you seeing there in terms of, you know, safety precautions? What are your concerns for the city in light of all this?
Well, if you look at the report and the message that came from our Tulsa County Health Department, the concerns are there. In fact, the warnings, the messages have been continual from those who are in, who operate and are the experts in that field, have just been saying that this is not the time to do this, to have an arena packed out with coronavirus cases even increasing around the country. It's very disheartening. But, you know, that's one of the tenements of living in a free society. People have the freedom to do what they want. The only problem is, as our Tulsa County Health Department has said, is that the concern is the gathering, and then when they leave that gathering, spread the potential that's there of spreading that out into the community. So I think everyone is concerned and understand that, you know, really wish this wouldn't happen now in our city because of coronavirus, but, you know, just pushing them to, you know, make sure that everybody wears a mask, you know, make sure that, you know, whatever precautions that can be taken, if you're going to do this, then take every precaution available so that you don't become a harm to those in the city or even when people return to their cities. And not carry this virus with them.
Yeah. Phil, as we mentioned, you are the project manager for the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. Tell us a little bit about your work. What exactly is the commission doing to commemorate this event and to teach the country and the world about what happened in Greenwood?
So we are planning a centennial series of events to commemorate the 100th anniversary. We actually we're just a couple of weeks away from the 99th. And we actually had a virtual, because of coronavirus, we had a virtual community conversation that was broadcast live. We had state elected officials, myself. We had an actual direct descendant survivor speak. And it was a wonderful time to kind of be the platform, the sounding board to the fact that we're pointing to 2021. We even had a candlelight vigil at 10:30, the moments when the first shots were fired. It was a beautiful, beautiful ceremony to remember those who lost their lives and survivors. So 2021, the commission, our main project is we're building an 11,000 square foot world-class museum grade narrative museum or exhibit called Greenwood Rising. And it will tell the story of this historic Greenwood. It will tell the story of the pioneers. It will, of course, be an immersive narrative experience of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. It'll talk about the rebuilding, its eventual second decline. But most importantly, at the end of the exhibit, it will have what we refer to as the Journey to Reconciliation. It'll be an amphitheater space where we can have programming where individuals can come and sit and discuss and have dialogue and have these tough discussions around race and what we're learning from the tragedies of the past and how we can be unified moving forward. We're planning that to be opened for the centennial. It's actually going to be built at Greenwood Avenue and Archer, which is the gateway to what was Black Wall Street. The second thing we're building is a pathway to hope, which will be a memorial walking path that will walk people from Greenwood through the Greenwood Avenue through the heart of Greenwood, what was once where the businesses and the homes were, and you'll walk right into the entrance of the John Hope Franklin Park, which is Pathway to Hope. And so those are our two major construction projects. Besides that, we have an education initiative to make sure this gets taught in Oklahoma public schools. We have a cultural tourism committee, an arts committee. We won a $1 million prize from the Bloomberg Philanthropies for a Greenwood arts project where there'll be many artists that will do projects around the community over the next year. So 2021 is going to be a phenomenal year of just remembering, commemorating, and the eyes of the world are going to be here in Tulsa in 2021, and we are preparing for that.
Well, and in fact, they already are, because as you mentioned, there is the HBO series Watchmen that has really sort of put this in front of us as a nation. I'm just curious, has that kind of attention from, you know, series like Watchmen, what has that done in terms of tourism in Tulsa? Have you seen an impact yet?
We definitely have seen an impact. With where I am now, I can actually look outside my office window and see where the construction will take place. And within walking distance of here are the historic Greenwood Chamber buildings, the Greenwood Cultural Center, where the current 1921 race massacre memorial stands, the historic Vernon AME Church, the only surviving structure from the 1921 riots that are still here. So all of this has been here, and we've been talking about this and we've been sharing this history. But when The Watchmen came out, it just drew such worldwide attention, and more so for the millennial age group, that the younger minded individuals, that just, how could this have happened and no one know about it? And so the foot traffic that has descended upon Greenwood, it's been significant and since Watchmen. And, of course, even this week with all the attention, with the presidential rally being here, it's just drawing more attention to this area, to its history, to its significance. It's just an indication. It's letting the city know that we're not being overly dramatic when we say, hey, we got to get prepared because thousands and thousands of people will be here next year. Everyone's getting a taste of what this history is doing in the hearts and minds of people, that they want to be here. They want to be here to commemorate with us when we say 100 years has gone by. What do we have to show for it? And we want to show people Tulsa is a different place than it was in 1921.
So obviously your work is so heavily focused on next year, on 2021, for the centennial. But what is your vision, Phil, and the vision of the commission for Greenwood and for Tulsa past 1921? What do you want to see happen there?
So overall, what we want to see is the resurgence of Black businesses, Black home ownership in this historic area of Greenwood. Our main focus will be, as the commission and our mission states, we just mainly seek to educate all United States citizens and literally the world about Tulsa's historic Greenwood district, the storied Black Wall Street, including the massacre, its impact on Oklahoma and the nation, and utilize an experiential, sustainable approach so that the commission can build social ties and unite communities around this history.
You mentioned a moment ago that at the end of the experience that you are working on for next year, you talked about the Journey to Reconciliation as a discussion space for hard conversations to be had. And in our last 90 seconds or so here, I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that, about the need for those conversations and perhaps how the events that we're watching play out every day right now are leading to some of those conversations.
Having conversation is the key. Sitting down with someone with intentionality that does not look like you, that does not have your background, that has a different perspective on life, and sitting down and having discussion. It sounds oversimplified. It sounds, how can that make an impact? When I get to know you as a person, when I get to understand a little bit of your experience and live a little bit through your eyes and walk through your shoes, I have a different respect. I gain a different perspective. We may not agree on everything, but I will value you and your human life, human shared experience, and I'll be less critical. I'll be more open to the things that you experience. I will understand that when someone says Black lives matter, it doesn't mean that no other lives matter. It just means right now we're needing your help with an immediate urgency of what's taking place in a particular subset of this community, so that if you don't stop it here, it's going to spread to other communities. Understanding what the true story of people's lives are can be can be powerful motivators for people to sit down and walk away with a greater respect, a greater unity, and say, you know what, I need to be a part of this, and I need to be a person with intentionality, make things better in terms of race relations in my own life, in my own spheres of influence, and in my own community.
Well, Phil, we wish you the very best as you continue with this major project for the centennial for next year, and I just want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You as well. That was Phil Armstrong. He's the project director for the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. Our producers are John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and our engineer today has been Diana Martinez.